Well, I'm here with Melissa Park, the former federal member for the seat of Fremantle in the National Parliament. Melissa, thank you very much for agreeing to speak with Fremantle Shipping News.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's really a pleasure to be here with you and to be featured on your new website, Fremantle Shipping News, a wonderful creative initiative, very typical of the Fremantle spirit, I think. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. And now, it's not that long since you ceased to be our local federal member. How are you doing?
Oh, absolutely wonderfully, thank you, Michael. Especially now since the state election, that Row 8 has been canned. And I've been participating in some of the protests just to see that result of the community coming together in such a powerful way and absolutely without any thought of giving it up at any point. Just this had to be beaten. It was so wrong. It just had to be beaten. And now to see a process of healing started involving Indigenous people and other community members, I just think it's so wonderful and I'm feeling great. Having handed over my role essentially to Josh Wilson, who's just fabulous, it gives me a great deal of peace of mind that knowing that the people of Fremantle are going to be well looked after.
The Row 8, it seems to me, without making any particular comment about it, has been one of the more remarkable urban and environmental issues in this state for some time. It seemed quite an intense reaction.
Absolutely. And how utterly immoral for the government to have issued contracts and started work on this just before a state election, knowing that the opposition was opposed to it. I just think it's unconscionable that they did that. And it reminded me of a battle I was involved in back in the early 90s when I was a solicitor at the Bunbury Community Legal Centre. I got involved in the Communities for Coastal Conservation, which was opposed to a industrial port being set up in Kemerton, which is just north of Australind. And that area is a key environmental reserve. And there was a coalition of the community, farmers, scientists, local governments, basically everybody opposed to it. And it felt very similar to the No Row 8 community banding together. And back in the 90s, we did defeat that port, industrial port, and the community has done the same thing here. And it's just terrific to have people coming from so many different walks of life and all being so committed and finally succeeding. And the damage that's been done is horrific to behold. But I think there'll be a lot of joy in replanting and bringing the animals back and all the things that will happen. And I'm the patron of Native ARC, the Native Animal Rescue Centre at Bibra Lake. It's one of the two kind of official functions I've kept, official roles I've kept since I left my role as an MP. And that's just... it's so precious now that's going to be saved.
Maybe in one of the small areas that were cleared, they can create some sort of memorial to what happened and a reminder of the disaster that took place in that
sense. And particularly in relation to our Indigenous community here. I mean, that place is sacred to Aboriginal people. It was an important birthing site, an important place where they held ceremonies. And that's only common sense if you think about it. It's a very important water system going down our coastline, and it's absolutely I don't know how to say this, but I remember Reverend Celan Garlett talking with the most incredible force at one of the protest rallies. He just said, This is the soul that's being destroyed here, the soul of our people and the soul of the land. And And I think now we can all move on knowing that that's going to be brought back.
So I take it you didn't get arrested like some people did?
I didn't. My husband, Warwick, forbade me absolutely from getting arrested. Yes, I mean, the only way he would let me go out of the house at 5 a.m. to go and join the protest was on the condition that I didn't get myself arrested. And so it's the first time I've ever been married. It's the first time I've ever paid any real attention to my personal life as opposed to working. And I thought I'd better, you know, go along with that one for the time. I mean, I've only been married for just over a year, so I don't want to get divorced so quickly.
Now, this was a big issue, and it's been smouldering in the state and in Fremantle for some time. And during the period you were a parliamentarian, but you're not a parliamentarian now. Has it sunk in that you're not? Is life different post formal politics?
Oh yes, it's very different. I miss being around Fremantle people all the time and being involved in the community and everything that's going on. I do miss that aspect. What I don't miss is the parliament and the political games and the nastiness that I think is very much a feature of what's going on in Canberra. I don't miss that. And I don't miss going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards across the country. And the eastern states, there's no recognition given to people from the west or any other outlying part of Australia. You know, the world for them revolves around the east, those little eastern triangle, and the rest of us can go jump. And I think you know, that makes it harder for people coming from Western Australia. It makes it harder for people with young families, especially women. I haven't analysed the latest makeup of the parliament, but certainly when I was an MP, the only women in the parliament from Western Australia were those who either had grown children or no children. And I think that's just the way it is.
It's obviously a very hard gig. I've observed over the years just what's required. If you have to leave Canberra on a Thursday or a Friday night and you have to change planes, or even if you've got a direct flight, it is a long way. Do you see any remedy for that, or is it just going to be effective parliamentary life?
I do, actually. I think the more technology evolves, I think, and the more that you get younger people moving into the parliament, I think there'll slowly be a transition to doing more and more of the parliamentary work through technology, through video conferencing or whatever. There will be some things like when votes need to be held where I think they'll absolutely require that members be there. But I think committee work and other things could probably start to be done a bit more remotely, and that's got to happen.
Now tell me, just talking about your days in Canberra, And you had a wonderful reputation for standing up for principles and on issues where you had strong views, I think, before you went into Parliament, and you obviously remained true to them. What were the great high points, if there were? There might have been some low points, I don't know, but how do you look back? Are there the fond parts of your time in Parliament, and what are they?
Right. Well, very early on, there was the apology to the Stolen Generations. I think that was, you know, definitely a high point. There were some high points with things that we achieved here in Fremantle, with you know, getting the return of Cantonment Hill from the Defence Department, a lot of infrastructure spending for local government, for schools, and community organisations here in Fremantle, Coburn area. And so I'm very, very proud of all those things. I was really proud of the Marine Sanctuaries decision the government's decision to create the world's largest network of marine reserves in the world. That's been put on hold during the present government's time, but I hope that if Labor regains government, that will come back. There's, you know, the investment in renewable energy, and which has seen the number of households with solar PV panels. It's gone. I think it was around 10,000 Australia wide when John Howard was Prime Minister, and now it's in the millions. And you know, Fremantle is a great example. I mean, there would be 100,000 in Fremantle alone. I'm talking wider Fremantle area.
Yes.
Let alone further out. So, you know, it's just been such a huge boost, I think, to the renewable energy movement. Unfortunately, that's sort of been stalled again, of course, under the present government, but again, hopefully that will change. Ending of discrimination against same-sex couples in more than 80 Commonwealth laws. I think that was really significant.
We don't have marriage law though.
No, we don't, and that's got to come. It's got to come soon. I just think it's inevitable. It's where Australia is going, and those few dinosaurs that are holding it back in the Commonwealth Parliament, they will eventually go into history. Where they belong, and we will have marriage equality. Even before that, I mean, taking away the discrimination, those laws around, you know, welfare entitlements and superannuation and all sorts of things has just been really important to so many people. Abolishing the ability of the states to reintroduce the death penalty, you know, all of those sorts of things, which may be a bit loyally, I suppose, that it's maybe not the everyday concerns of people, but they're really significant. And animal welfare, I mean, it's got a long way to go. But the Labor Party has made really significant progress in this area since I went into Parliament. It didn't have anything in the national platform. There was nothing on animal welfare when I first came in, and then over the years, we've seen Labor adopt a commitment to establishing an independent office of animal welfare, which I think is absolutely critical to get the ministry responsible for animal welfare. Not being the Department of Agriculture, because there's an inherent conflict of interest. It's just insane. It would be like putting the Minister for Mines in charge of the environment. You just don't do it. It's like putting the fox in charge of the hen house. You don't do it. Unfortunately, that's all the governments of Australia have done that, and we need to change that. So having an independent office that reports to some other department or some other minister than the Minister for Agriculture, I think, is fundamental, not only around live export, but around all kinds of areas of animal welfare. And I hope that happens at the state level as well, an independent office. And I've been certainly talking to the new state government about that kind of idea. So animal welfare is one thing. On the human rights front, I think Australia's really gone backwards.
Let me get you to pause there for a moment.
Yeah.
You came in with the Kevin 07 push.
Yeah.
And they were exciting times, obviously, for supporters of the Labor government at that time, and you were newly elected.
Mm.
At that stage, and some of this, of course, is well documented, what were your ambitions in politics? You came from a background, as is said almost in quotes, a human rights lawyer, UN lawyer. What were your ambitions and what were your hopes at the point you came in?
Well, first and foremost, I said to myself when I went into it that I would always be true to those values, and I wasn't going to give them up for anything. And if that meant that I was never going to be promoted, well, so be it. And a number of times I spoke up in caucus at times when, in my very first term, when I think one time was, I think it was the... It's 2009, there was a big blitz on Gaza, and it was over the summertime, and of course there was no caucus sitting then. Had to wait till February to raise it, and the Australian government had only said that it supported Israel's right to defend itself. And I stood up in the caucus then and I said, well, if we want to be taken seriously on the international stage, we have to be balanced in our approach, and we also have to talk about both sides of this conflict, not just one side, and talk about it from the point of view of international law and human rights, because that way, you're completely safe if on safe ground if you do that. And so that was, that both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, because Julia Gillard had been the responsible acting Prime Minister at the time. They looked very uncomfortable, but I think they respected what I had to say because I'd lived there myself and knew the region. Another time I spoke up about the death penalty. It was around the time when there was coming up the anniversary of the Bali bombing. And Kevin Rudd, when he was opposition leader, had made a very big deal out of talking about how he opposed the death penalty and had you had to be always consistent in doing that. And then suddenly, during this anniversary of the Bali bombing, the government was starting to say things like, well, these people deserve the harshest penalty and all that sort of thing. And I made a speech in Parliament saying, well, no, we have to be absolutely consistent in our, when we're talking about these matters. We can't just oppose the death penalty sometimes and support it in other cases. You just have to oppose it no matter who the person is that's being it's been given the death penalty. And I was hauled over the coals for that by the Chief of Staff at the time.
What was the difficulty?
Kevin Rudd's Chief of Staff. Oh, just that, it was very unfortunate timing and I needed to be a bit more circumspect, and they thought I had great prospects but that I needed to, maybe seek some advice before I made my my speeches.
Let me ask you another question about
that. But, basically what I say is, is that I never stopped actually speaking up on things, and it was therefore quite a surprise when I first got the promotion to Parliamentary Secretary for Mental Health, Homelessness and Social Housing, and then the same year to Minister for International Development. I was very pleased and happy, of course, because that was my dream job, being Minister for International Development. But it was sort of in spite of myself that it happened, and that's why I was surprised as well as delighted.
The question I wanted to ask was a personal one. Some people who are interested in public affairs and politics might wonder about. I mean, the beauty of our system of democracy is that, and I think more than theory, I think in practice, that ordinary people we all know can somehow, someday, be elected to Parliament because they have the passion and the interest. But what training do people have? What is it like at a personal level to stand up in the National Parliament, in the House of Representatives, in your case, as the member for Fremantle and speak? Were you nervous? Did you go through periods? Did you have training for this? Did your past life prepare you for this?
Some people say that having been a lawyer is a sort of natural training, in the sense of being an advocate and being familiar with drafting and looking at legislation, and that's certainly true to some extent. But I was incredibly conscious of the fact that of the more than 1,000 members of the House of Representatives since Federation when I started, only 80-odd were women, and I was one of those. And I just thought, well, that's just insane. And I did feel a great responsibility to represent the people of Fremantle fully, and more than that, to look to the national interest in everything. And thinking about that really helped me. I remember just before when I was initially a candidate, this is actually when I left the UN. On my way home, I stopped in at a 40th birthday party of one of my former colleagues from Gaza in Spain. And while I was there, actually, it was maybe a 50th birthday party. I can't remember anymore. While I was there, I was talking to this woman, and I was telling her I was about to go home and run for parliament. And she said, "Oh, that's great." And I said, "How are you feeling about that?" And I said, "Oh, look, I'm feeling pretty nervous actually." She said, "You know, get over yourself." She said, "It's not about you, is it? It's about the causes and the issues that you care about and that your people care about." And I thought, that's true. And that's what has always given me a great deal of ballast, I suppose, in going out there and talking about things, knowing that it'll be unpopular with my colleagues and with many of the people in the parliament, but knowing it is it's not about me, it's not about what people think of me, it's about that issue getting the voice that it deserves. And that's what's really driven me in the parliament. And I was still nervous, of course, when I got in there, but over time that goes I think it takes a while to find your feet in that place.
What are the most unusual features about the parliament, the things that surprised you or that you've found odd and never got used to?
Well, it's a little bit like a parallel universe, parliament. It doesn't bear much relationship to anything outside of parliament except perhaps for a giant boarding house. But having never been to boarding school, it's only what I imagine a boarding school is like. But I mean, you're in there from 7 in the morning till, like when I was there, mostly midnight. You're running around. Every moment of your day is accounted for. At least my day was. I mean, you could be slack if you wanted to and not go to things and not participate in committees and not do the reading and that. But I was always a bit conchy, and I always would do all of that. And so it's absolutely exhausting, but it's also very removed from real life and everyday life. And I think the longer people are in there, it's a bit of a danger that you sort of do lose touch with reality. I mean, I know MPs come back regularly to be in their constituencies, and that's really important. But if you're a minister or a shadow minister, you do that less. You're spending your time roaming around the country. And it really means, I think, that the longer you're doing it, the less I think that you are connected with the community. And I think the other thing that's happened in recent years is the types of people going into parliament have narrowed. So you've got more party political animals going in, professional politicians in a way, who've gone out of university and walked straight into a job with the party or with a member of parliament or with a trade union or with a minister, and that's their whole life, and then they're on a track themselves to becoming an MP. And there will always be those sorts of people in parliament, but what you don't want is for that to be the majority. You want people from all walks of life, from all types of backgrounds and ethnicities.
Is that
to be in the parliament, and we don't have that at the moment.
Is that a common issue, as you said, for all the parties, the major parties?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean,
it's a way of
it's starting. It's improving with regard to women, and I really do think that you know, Labor's improved a lot with regard to women, whereas the Conservative parties and the Nationals and the Libs have not done so well because they have not had quotas. Quotas have been essential to improving women's representation in Labor. Without that, you simply would not have had the same number of women. And I think there have even been some women in the Liberal Party now who are supporting, who have supported quotas, because they see that without them, they're just simply not going to happen.
Well, there's gender balance, but then there's this wider issue you're talking about, where people are drawn from.
We want
from
more
in
Indigenous people. We need more people from different ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds. And yeah, it's that's what we've got to do. We've got to make our parliament more diverse so that it is representative of the community, because it isn't at the moment. It's still a lot of older white men running things, as it always has been, you know.
Is there such a thing as the natural and good politician who can last the distance and understands the process and may get into trench warfare but is respectful of their colleagues or her colleagues and for whom politics is made, or can anybody do it?
I would say that Parliament should be made up of everyday people. Absolutely. You don't want the Parliament to be full of people who think they all should be Prime Minister. You need the Parliament to be full of people who reflect society. Now, Ricky Muir, when he came in, he was generally held to be a bit of a laughing stock. You know, they had videos of him on the internet throwing kangaroo poo around, and you know, but he came into that place and he learned and he listened and he actually started reflecting that back in his speeches and in his work, and he really did a fantastic job. Unfortunately, he wasn't re-elected, but he, you know, he's an example of someone who came from a very humble background, and Glenn Lazarus too. I mean, a former rugby player. You know, they came in. He came in through Palmer United and split with Clive in the end, like the others did. But you know, he stood up for everyday people, and you know, that wasn't, nobody could foresee that happening. But you know, they were in the end doing what everybody would expect all politicians to do, or parliamentarians. I describe myself as a parliamentarian, not a politician.
The people you've just mentioned, of course, were in the Senate, and in the Australian electoral system is more likely to produce individuals, if that's the way of putting it, and it has. I mean, do you see the way the Senate operates now and is elected as being reflective of an Australian society? Is it a good thing?
No, I mean, I think it's been a bit of a dog's breakfast. Particularly with the entry rise of One Nation. That's been a disaster. That is a disaster for our country for them to have part of the balance of power means they have a lot more power and credence given to them than they should. With Arthur Sinodinos and others saying that they've become a sophisticated party when clearly they haven't. It's just that they need them to get their bills through, so they're going to promote them and treat them with respect, and they certainly don't deserve it. And I'm really worried about it. There'll have to be a determination from all of the other parties to deal with it for it to change.
We seem to be living in, perhaps we always have to some extent or another, a time when the anti-politician appeals to the elector. And in some ways, some people have suggested in Fremantle your very individual and personal response to issues made you a very popular local candidate. The anti-politician, if you are one, I'm not sure whether you would accept that classification, can come in various guises, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, just look at the success of Bernie Sanders in the recent US election. I mean, he really is that person, you know, the anti-politician on the left.
And Trump on the face of it, on the right.
Although Trump's message is very mangled. Some of it's coming from the left and some of it's coming from the right, and he manages to just say enough to appeal to people from lots of different perspectives. Yeah, so, but Bernie Sanders was I really, really loved what he talked about. I thought he was very courageous and you know, again, someone who speaks from the heart. And that's really, people want to know that their MPs are acting in what they believe to be the national interest and in their community's interest. And even if they don't agree with them, they will overwhelmingly respect them for it. What they don't want is someone getting up there and spouting lines. Politicians used to be able to get away with that, but I think in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe a bit more, people have started seeing through that, and they won't accept that anymore.
Now, Fremantle. Come back to Fremantle.
Yes.
And you were the member for
Wonderful
Fremantle.
Wonderful Fremantle.
It is. It's the most magical place on the planet. But
yeah.
What demands are there, both politically and just in practical terms, in being the member for Fremantle? We've got a very strong sort of communities here. We've got people with differing life experiences. There's an ethos that one assumes about Fremantle.
But it's true too. Fremantle is a place of arrival. It's a place of welcome. It's multicultural. It's outward looking. It's not closed in on itself. And you know, the first thing that struck me when I first arrived here, having left the UN and come from New York back to Fremantle, that there was some criticism of me before I arrived, like people saying, "Who is this woman? Why is an American coming to stand for Parliament?" Not understanding that I was an Australian working in the UN. But then once I arrived, all of that stopped. Once people understood that I had been working away with the UN, doing human rights issues, etc., it was as if I was being welcomed into the family, Fremantle family. That I just felt, wow, I'm home. And I felt like that the whole time I was the member. And even now I still feel like that. People are still so lovely and kind to me. And it's a community that is so caring about the world, that, where, that phrase that's often used, local is global or vice versa. It's so true. This is what Fremantle epitomises for me. I mean, it's everything about that is here. Fremantle people, they care about, they see the universal in the local and vice versa. When you're fighting against Row 8, it's not just about a bloody great freeway going through a wetland, a precious wetland. It's about wider Indigenous culture. It's about what's happening to the planet and the devastation of species and biodiversity and how we're dealing with climate change. And, all of those things, human rights of Aboriginal people, people's right to health, it's all of those things coming in together, and that's Fremantle to me. And it's also a creative community. You've got all these writers and artists and musicians and performers and academics all living here, and judges, of course. And I don't think it's any accident that we also have an enormous number of inventors living in Fremantle, because that's what creativity brings. And so you've just got this incredible community that can see great detail, but also see the bigger picture.
Now, Melissa,
that's what I love about it.
Where did all of this passion? Where did all of these ideals come from? Where did they spring from? When did you first know you were possessed in this way?
I think it's a park trait, because from what I've learned about my predecessors in the parks, they were always pretty bolshy people they were farmers, but unusual in being on the left, always very concerned about the environment, always wanting to save trees. Like my great uncle George Park was on the council, the Donnybrook Council, for many years, and the council had always wanted to bulldoze all of the big trees down the main street, and he always stopped them. And it was when he died, they chopped them all down. Of course, now they've planted all more. They've seen that was a big mistake, and they've planted them again. But my dad, they were doing a road widening in the southwest a few years ago, and there were the department of main roads had put these pink ribbons around the trees that were not going to be bulldozed. And there was this Christmas tree that Dad absolutely loved. And Christmas trees take, hundreds of years to grow. And this was a big tree. So, you know, it was very old. And it was it didn't have a pink ribbon around it. And Dad was devastated at the idea this tree was going to was bulldozed. So he goes up to Bunnings and buys some pink ribbon. In the middle. And then in the very early in the morning, he goes out and ties this pink ribbon around the tree. And sure enough, they didn't bulldoze that tree. And to my knowledge, I don't think anyone has been killed in an accident by banging into that tree. So I don't think he created a safety hazard. But it's kind of ran in the family. And also, you know, when I was very young, 1975, I was 9, was when the dismissal happened. And I know that my family were outraged by that, and very strong Whitlam supporters, and I took on all of that reform that happened in the Whitlam era, the legal reforms, the social reforms, you know, the cultural reforms. It was an incredible period in our history, and that stayed with me. And I think, you know, I'm really a child of the Whitlam era. And that's what's infused me, you know, most strongly with my sense of justice, and plus, you know, obviously it's quite genetic as well, long line of troublemakers. my great uncle George used to write poetry for the Bulletin about, you know, the treatment of Aboriginal people, and this was going back, you know, in the 30s and 40s kind of thing. So, I think it's kind of inbred into me. And it's something I can't really do anything about, nor would I want to.
One thing we haven't avoided, but in the course of the various issues you've become known for, haven't touched on to date, is the question of refugee policy in Australia.
Absolutely appalling.
Are you optimistic that things can change? Is the world position such that we won't see change?
I do think in Australia, there's more and more, among everyday Australians, there's more and more of a realisation, a recognition of what is happening on Manus and Nauru, and that it is really unacceptable. And when you're seeing doctors and nurses and teachers and grandmothers all coming and protesting and having acts of civil disobedience, refusing to let children out of hospital if they're going to be sent, you know, off to Nauru, you know, then you really, that, you know, it's mainstream now that this situation has to be fixed. And I think now that's why we're seeing this sort of people swap arrangement with the United States sort of being brought about, because it's clear to all of the it's clear to the government that they can't go on with it, because it's, you know, it's just unacceptable. And but I think the role of the parliament and the government in this episode has been shameful. And, you know, I've stood up in parliament and apologised on behalf of the parliament and my colleagues and everybody for this happening, because we should never have allowed that to happen. And Labor especially, because Labor purports to have all these human rights values, and I don't think that was very evident, or is very evident, in our policies to date. I do think it's changing, but, you know, while I was there, it was absolutely appalling.
Is party politics, at a more general level, a natural or an easy or an obvious thing in the present climate, present world climate?
Party politics. I said to my colleagues, I'm very happy to be a team player as long as the team's doing the right thing. But the team's doing the wrong thing, I'm not going there. I can't really speak for the Liberal Party, the Labor Party. I think there is obviously a purpose to having collectivism, to behaving in a unified way, because that's how workers manage to get reforms to their working conditions and salary pay and things over the years, was by being united. Now, I understand that completely. But I think the Labor Party needs to reform in the way the Australian Labor Party does, in the way that, say, the British Labor Party has done. That is, that there's got to be more democracy, within the party, and that includes the caucus. I mean, you can speak up as a member of the British Labour Party. You can speak out against party policy. You can vote against party policy and not be expelled. You can't do that in the Australian Labour Party. And I don't think that's natural. I think if you're a democratic party and you acknowledge that it's a broad-based party, it's a broad-spectrum party, you know, you've got to accommodate a lot of different views, you've got to let those views be expressed. And if you don't, you know, you're creating a problem for yourself. What was the other thing? Refugee policy. I think, you know, the Western world in particular is in a bit of denial about the future, because there is going to be increased people movements, displacement from now on, you know, indefinitely, from climate change, from conflict, from whatever cause. And there is going to have to be a reckoning that the global community has got to get together and work out how to deal with this issue. It's not going away. It's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it won't all come under the heading of refugee, dealing with refugees, because obviously people displaced by climate change or by famine, as we're seeing in Africa now at the moment as well, are not refugees in the sense of having been persecuted. But they are nevertheless needing to move, and they will move to survive.
So how can you foresee the world community responding? Will it be the UN? Will it be some leading country actors in this? And how might they do it?
I think maybe initially it might be regional bodies that are getting together. But ultimately, I think the United Nations has to address it. But the fact that we haven't really been able to deal with climate change in any effective way yet, I think means that there's still a failure to acknowledge what's actually going on. That we're talking an existential issue here, and until there's a sense of urgency about it that everyone has, then we're not going to get effective action. And I think the same is true of the people movements, unfortunately.
The other issue we've not talked about, which was obviously important to you when you came into politics and as you leave, is the state of the Middle East, and in particular Israel and Palestine. And there's been a change of president in the United States, and there's been new moves in relation to what's happening. What are you more optimistic or less so now that...
I don't think so. what's happened in more recent years is that Israel's leadership has moved from a position of pretending to support the two-state solution while meantime building as many settlements, which they call facts on the ground, as possible, which would thereby make it practically and physically impossible for a two-state solution, because, you know, if you've got settlements everywhere, how are the Palestinians ever going to have a properly functioning state? And so I think now that they've moved on from that now, they don't pretend that they want a two-state solution. Almost all of Israel's leadership is now openly saying they don't support two-state solution anymore. So what's the alternative? The alternative is one state. And I think as Israel sees it now, it's one state where Israel continues to control the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, almost totally in some instances, in most instances. And their economy and you know, any relationships they can have. If you look at the universities in the West Bank and in Gaza, I mean, foreign academics can't come to those universities unless Israel gives them a visa, and often they don't get one. So that's just one little example. This is an issue where it's not complicated. The issues are very clear. Everyone knows what they are. It's not one of those grey situations where it's all very It's very mucky and murky. We don't know exactly where the right is. I mean, it's very clear. And if you look at it from a human rights perspective and from an international law perspective, it's very clear. And the International Court of Justice has set out its opinion on these matters, whether it's about the refugees or the wall or the settlements. And so now Israel is openly against a two-state solution. Australia has to work out what it's going to do. The occupation has been going for decades now. It's clearly untenable for, you know, as a permanent situation. And it will lead Israel into being an official apartheid state. And I know Israelis will deny that, but if you look at it, people like Desmond Tutu say it already is. And Nelson Mandela, before he died, had given those sorts of pronouncements as well. So, you know, I think what will happen now is the international community will increasingly come in against Israel and declare it an apartheid state. And the only thing that's stopped the international community doing it to date has been the United States vetoing resolutions. But and I guess with President Trump there, that's likely to continue for a while. But ultimately, I do believe that you know, Israel will become a pariah state if it doesn't change its behaviour.
Now,
or is not forced to change its behaviour.
Now, we could keep talking for a long, long time, but
yeah,
we have to bring this to an end. I just want to ask you a couple of questions which arise out of everything we've spoken about. As you said earlier, you left the parliament, and before that you married, as you said, for the first time. You are still no doubt disengaging from politics, but and the regular rush of going to Canberra, coming back and doing all the things associated with being a member of parliament. But have you set some sort of set of aspirations for yourself at this point for the time ahead?
Not really. I'm still reflecting on all of that. This is essentially the first significant break I've had in 17 years, with, you know, 8 years with the UN and 9 years in Parliament. And I'm enjoying having some time with my family, who are sort of in Donnybrook and 2J, and my husband's family, and I'm a step-grandmother now, with some very active step-grandchildren. And I do think it's important to have a step back and to just reflect and take time to just work out where I want to go from here. And I'm obviously still very interested in various causes and issues.
We haven't heard the last of you.
No. I fear not. I'm just having a little break at the moment, but I'll be back in some capacity or another, but I doubt it will be anywhere near the federal parliament.
Well, Melissa, thank you for agreeing to talk and share those thoughts and giving us some insights into what it was like to be in the parliament and to take on the sorts of issues you did. Obviously, you were up to it. We all know that, and you're obviously very committed to it, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Michael. Very much.